Welcome back, Clinical Problem Solver.
Just a reminder that this podcast is intended to be purely educational and is not meant as medical advice. Any patient information has been modified to protect the patient's identity. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers.
Enjoy the show.
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers, to another episode of the Spaced Learning Series. I am one of your hosts, Mukun, a medical student from California. It's very exciting to be back with my two brilliant co-hosts, Jazz and Vale. How are you both? How are you, Jazz?
I'm doing great. Thanks for asking, Mukun. I've had a busy week at the hospital, but can't complain overall. And I'm getting excited for my upcoming trip to Peru. And I'm excited to discuss the case that Vale has for us. Also, I'm just very grateful that I didn't get fired from telling that jazz joke in the last episode. Vale, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you for asking. I'm very happy to see you both again and discuss this case. Just to say that it's a very great case. I'm very excited to, you know, honored really to be joined by these two people that are so brilliant. So get ready for a lot of learning. On a little life update, I'm deep in a step two dedicated, so rescue me, please. But then I'm running my first marathon, my first full marathon this upcoming Sunday. So I'm very scared. But yeah, bring all your best wishes and hopefully I make it through the finish line.
You're going to do great, Vale.
Yeah, that is truly impressive. I don't think that I can say anything as exciting as I'm running a marathon, but I am a big fish tank enthusiast, and I recently got my first fish for this planted tank I've been curating for the last half a year or so. One of them, sadly, is suffering from some swim bladder issues, which I'm not capable of diagnosing. But overall, it's been cute to have some new company at home.
Wait, I gotta ask, what the hell is swim bladder issues?
You know, fish have this it's like an air bubble inside them that helps them regulate how deep in the water they are. And if they have swim bladder issues, if they have too much air in there, sometimes they just get stuck at the top of the tank. They look really goofy.
Mukund, wow. I feel like, I mean, we should add like to your titles, like Mukund, medical student, brilliant future physician, astrophotographer, and now like biological or like marine biologist. What is this? You say like, you know, bladder issues on fish as if it was like common knowledge. That's so funny. But very cute that you have new pets.
You all flatter me too much. Vale, I'm very excited for your case. Why don't you start us off with the first aqua?
Perfect. So the case that I have today is of a 33-year-old woman that presents to the ED with a 4-day history of headache. She's a prima gravida of 23 weeks of gestation and refers a history of migraines since she was a teenager. However, for the last 4 days, her headaches are different in pattern. Just to give you a little bit of context, before she had a unilateral headache, like a throbbing type of headache that was preceded by an aura. But now she presents with a holocephalic headache that had progressively worsened, of a throbbing nature that gets worse with Valsalva maneuvers and does not improve with acetaminophen. She denies light sensitivity, nausea, vomiting, or an aura. So with all this information, what do you think, Jas?
Wow, what a rich aliquot to start us off. So I will start off by breaking down the approach to a headache. I typically look at a headache as a primary versus secondary headache. Primary headaches include tension headaches, which by far is the most common primary headache. Other causes of primary headache are migraines and trigeminal autonomic cephalgias, from which cluster headaches is the most frequently encountered of this overall rare category. As for secondary headaches, I personally love the anatomical approach to a secondary headache, and the schema can actually be found on our website. It breaks it down into intracranial, head and neck, and systemic buckets. So let's go into these individually. Intracranial includes meninges, brain, cerebral blood vessels. Examples of these would include meningitis, encephalitis, and subarachnoid hemorrhage. Head and neck would include categories such as eyes, ears, nose, the sinuses, jaw, teeth, and neck. Examples of these include sinusitis, dental abscess, TMJ dysfunction, neck strains that lead to occipital neuralgias. Lastly, systemic bucket includes infections outside of the central nervous system, such as pneumonia, UTI, cellulitis, etc. Other systemic buckets include uncontrolled hypertension and medication side effects, some common ones being blood pressure medications, nitrates, and medication overuse headaches, such as NSAIDs and acetaminophen. I also would like to tease apart potential red flags that may come with the headaches, as I do think that this can help guide the clinician to suspect a secondary headache. Some red flags to mention would be thunderclap quality. This may suggest a vascular etiology. Is the headache worse with coughing, sneezing, straining, which would suggest elevated intracranial pressure? Is this a new headache in an older patient that may suggest a mass lesion or inflammatory disease? Or is this a new headache in a patient with history of cancer that may suggest metastatic disease? And lastly, is there any concern for headache and seizure or headache and neurological signs that may suggest focal lesions within the central nervous system? It can be very challenging to remember all of these important red flags, which is why I like to share a mnemonic that is popular within the VMR world. It's called Snoop. Now watch me drop it like it's hot. S stands for systemic symptoms such as fever, metabolic endocrinopathies. N stands for neoplasm of the brain, whether primary or secondary. The O stands for onset of headache, though that is sudden in onset, suggestive of subarachnoid hemorrhage or intracranial / extracranial vascular dissections. The second O stands for headaches that happen after 50 years of age, suggesting the possibility of a giant cell arteritis, cranial or extracranial vascular disorders, neoplasms, etc. And P stands for positional headaches, suggesting intracranial hypertension. All right, now let's bring the headache schema to our patient presented here. So this is a young pregnant woman that has a history of migraines, but now is having progressive headache that is different quality than her usual migraines. Often, when patients with known primary headache syndromes present with headaches, we frequently attribute the headache to their known syndrome. In this case, there are two reasons why I think it's difficult to settle on the migraine hypothesis from the get-go. First, the headache is a different character than her usual history. We need to put emphasis on what the patient tells us here. Furthermore, pregnancy is known to most often reduce the severity and frequency of migraines. However, I would like to point out that in some small amounts of cases, migraines can increase in frequency in the first trimester and decrease as the pregnancy continues. Thus, while it's plausible for this to be a migraine, consideration of alternative causes is important before settling on migraine. I also would be curious to see if there are any positive or negative symptoms associated with her headache. What are positive and negative symptoms, you may ask? Well, migraines typically have positive symptoms such as tingling and scintillating scotoma, which is a type of visual aura. Negative symptoms such as numbness or visual field deficits, which would typically be seen in strokes. And migraines will almost never present with negative symptoms, which is why it is important to obtain a detailed review of symptoms. Finally, given her pregnancy, one should always think about preeclampsia and help. However, there are a few things I want to point out that as of right now makes this less likely. Preeclampsia, even though it can happen after 20 weeks of gestation, it is typically a disorder that occurs between 34 to 37 weeks of gestation. Furthermore, HELP syndrome can occur in late second trimester, but is typically a syndrome that occurs between 28 to 37 weeks of gestation. Only 20% of HELP syndrome cases occur before 28 weeks of gestation, and a simple CBC can help further provide clarity. I personally think the most important detail in the first aliquot would be the headache that worsens with Valsalva maneuver, which makes me worried for elevated intracranial pressure. And my no-miss diagnoses for this situation would be intracranial tumor or mass, hydrocephalus, or idiopathic intracranial hypertension. One can also have elevated intracranial pressure from meningitis, and the textbook example we may all be familiar with is Cryptococcus neoformans, but can be seen in bacterial or even viral meningitis. Lastly, given her hypercoagulable state of pregnancy, we should consider venous sinus thrombus, and given her history of migraines, reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome, or RCVS, is also possible. Oh man, I told you this was going to be a very rich aliquot and so much to talk about. So let's summarize. This is likely a secondary headache, given the change in quality of her known history of migraines, and a persistent headache in a pregnant patient. And we can approach the secondary headache schema anatomically, intracranial, head and neck, and systemic buckets, focusing specifically on the intracranial category here, given our concern for increased intracranial pressure with headaches worsening with Valsalva.
Wow, yes, that was amazing. I love how you emphasize the importance of, you know, taking a step back before thinking about intracranial secondary causes of headache and thinking or ruling out if this can be extracranial as well, just because I feel like we always forget that the skull and the neck can also contribute to headache symptoms. I feel like for this patient, what really stood out to me when I saw her in the ED was the fact that she emphasized so much that this was different, that this was not the only, like the usual pattern of her headache. And I feel like for this patient especially, we really had to, you know, advocate for her to be taken seriously because, you know, in a very busy ED, a patient that has a history of migraines can just be like tagged as, okay, it's a migraine attack and not, you know, paid much attention. But okay, so continuing with the case, her past medical history includes chronic migraines, as I said, peripheral facial nerve palsy 8 months ago that resolved spontaneously, and a previous miscarriage 2 years ago. Her medications include a multivitamin, and she took for 7 years oral combined contraceptives until 3 years ago when she and her partner began their maternity journey. She does not smoke, consume alcohol, or other recreational drugs, and she works as a high school science teacher. So with all of this, what do you think, Mukund?
Yeah, you know, I also really appreciate the emphasis on, is this a deviation from the normal, and the emphasis on extracranial causes of headaches. You know, this is just recency bias, but I spent the last 2 weeks doing an oral surgery and dentistry rotation, you know, covering things that I think we don't really get taught about in medical school. And there were a fair number of patients I saw with TMJ dysfunction that was so severe that, you know, to the unsuspecting eye, it could have been considered a serious headache. So I love your approach to the schema, Jazz. But I also agree that this is a secondary headache, most likely at this point. This case is interesting for a lot of reasons, but I'll focus on one in particular for now. I don't often rotate on services where I'm working with pregnant patients. And pregnancy causes so many changes in physiology, it's worth zoning in on a couple aspects of the experience that could predispose her to a secondary headache. In the bucket of vascular processes, as Jazz has already identified, pregnancy is a hypercoagulable state. Namely, the increased circulating S-triol induces protein C and S resistance, making the intrinsic pathway of the coagulation cascade more active. Yeah, I bet you didn't expect to hear about the coag cascade in this episode, but here we are. Coagulation factors are also produced in greater quantities by the liver during pregnancy. So while we might think about further coagulopathy in a patient presenting with recurrent miscarriage, like factor V Leiden or antiphospholipid syndrome, a single miscarriage is unfortunately quite common. And this patient also doesn't have any other further exposures that could predispose to hypercoagulability, like smoking. So all of that's to say, while pregnancy can be hypercoagulable overall, and while venous sinus thrombosis needs to be ruled out in a pregnant patient with imaging, with MRI, MRV, it's much lower on my differential. That said, there's also another really interesting physiologic change in pregnancy that we should discuss, and that is a change in your immune status. It's easy enough to say that pregnancy is an immunocompromised state. I've definitely heard that a lot in my clinical education. And it's true in a matter of speaking, but the reality is a little more complex. The first several weeks of pregnancy may actually be a pro-inflammatory state in response to the invasive process of blastocyst implantation And the last weeks are again hyper-inflammatory in the lead up to delivery. So it's this intermediate stage, which happens to be the stage our patient is in, that regulatory T cells and anti-inflammatory cytokines suppress host immunity to protect the rapidly developing fetus. All that's to say, you know, it's a lot of talk, but overall, our patient is somewhat more susceptible to infections than our average patient, and the infectious etiology of secondary headache should be kept high on the differential, particularly given her exposure to a congregate environment. Not only does she have her own immune modulatory history effects, but she also works as a high school teacher, you know, full of kids who may be carrying any number of infections. And some of these culprit pathogens thrive in that environment. The last thing I want to point out is this tidbit about peripheral nerve palsy. So I'm going to really reach here and we'll see if it pays off. But timeline-wise, it appears to have occurred before the patient's pregnancy, which is interesting to note because while Bell's palsy is associated with pregnancy, it is by and large a feature of the third trimester. Many cases of Bell's palsy are idiopathic, but while we're on the subject of infection, reactivation of viruses like HSV, VZV, and infection with bugs like HIV and Lyme are known to be causes of facial nerve palsy and are also culprits for meningitis and or encephalitis. So, you know, I'd really be going fishing if I reached any further, but I'm just assuming Vale thinks it's important to have told us about it, and I'm keeping it in mind.
That was brilliant, Mukund. I love how you gave us like an amazing rundown of the physiology of pregnancy. I feel like it's very important to keep in mind, you know, the possibility that we can take care of pregnant people as well. So continuing with the case, on admission, her vitals were a blood pressure of 130 over 70, heart rate of 95, respiratory rate 18, temperature of 37.8 Celsius. Her physical exam reveals abnormal skin, lung, cardiac, and abdominal examination. And her neurological exam is remarkable for, well, she was oriented in time, place, and person. Cranial nerves show visual fields are symmetric. There's no ptosis. There's normal range of eye movements and preserved sensation on the face bilaterally. Symmetric and preserved facial movements are observed, and acoustic acuity to ramen fingers is normal. The uvula and tongue are not deviated, and shoulder elevation is symmetric. Strength is 4 over 5 in both lower extremities and 5 over 5 in the upper extremities. Deep tendon reflexes show a 2 over 4 in the right patellar and Achilles tendon, and also in the right and left brachial and radial reflexes, and a 3 over 4 in the deep tendon reflexes on the left patellar and Achilles reflexes. There is overall mild increase in tone in all four extremities. There's no dysmetria, diadochocinesia, and there's a normal gait as well. Sorry for this very quite big neuro exam, Jess.
No, please don't apologize. That's very, very lots of information and rich physical exam. And honestly, after Mukund going into that deep dive of pathophysiology of pregnancy, he set the bar quite high. So I'll give it my best here. First and foremost, when I look at this aliquot, I'm reassured by the vitals for the most part. And I can safely suggest that preeclampsia appears to be less likely given the normal blood pressure. It should be noted that she does have a low-grade fever, which to me suggests some form of inflammation. Vast majority of the physical exam is normal, except for the neurological system, which suggests to me that the disease is likely in the central nervous system. Combining the low-grade fever and the reassuring non-neurological exam, I currently wonder about an inflammatory process within the central nervous system. As for the neurological exam, I'm not sure. Honestly, I'm not sure what to make of the mildly reduced strength in the lower extremity. For now, I'm not going to put too much emphasis on this exam finding. There's no dysmetria, there's no dysdiadochinesia, which suggests to me that the cerebellum is probably not involved. I think what strikes me the most is the increased tone in all four extremities and the increased reflexes in the bilateral Achilles. This, to me, suggests an upper motor neuron lesion, such as brain, brainstem, and or spinal cord. In an upper motor neuron lesion, everything is up, such as muscle tone, reflexes, and Babinski sign, toes go up. Generally, upper motor neuron lesions have absent fasciculations and there's no atrophy of muscle bulk. In a lower motor neuron lesion, everything is down, such as muscle tone, reflexes, and Babinski sign, toes go down. Fasciculations may be present, and there's typically some atrophy of muscles, especially if this is a subacute to chronic process. A pearl that I learned from Dr. Berkowitz is the triple flexion sign. What is a triple flexion sign, one may ask? If the big toe is pinched, this stimulates a simultaneous dorsiflexion of the foot, knee flexion, and hip flexion. And this is pretty reliable to suggest an upper motor neuron lesion. Given there are no focal deficits that were observed on examination, this makes a focal lesion within the brain less likely. Given the cranial nerve exam being normal, I also would like to say that the brainstem is likely spared. Given the patient's pregnancy status, I do not want to miss an infectious process, as we know that pregnant patients have worse outcomes with infections, as wonderfully discussed by Mukund earlier. Let us zoom in to one of the buckets from the headache schema that was shared in the first Eloqua. The HMP and physical exam essentially makes the head and neck bucket and this less likely. And we did not really get a strong flavor of systemic symptoms other than a low-grade fever. So this leaves the intracranial bucket. As I suggested earlier, given the lack of focal deficits on neurological exam, a focal brain lesion appears to be less likely, which leaves us with the meninges. Given the lack of confusion, this makes me prioritize meningitis over encephalitis. But how can we tie together an upper motor neuron lesion like hyperreflexia and increased muscle tone and meningitis? Well, meningitis can lead to hyperreflexia and increased muscle tone through several mechanisms, but I will highlight a couple. Irritation of the inflamed meninges can lead to a disruption of the inhibitory pathways within the central nervous system that normally help regulate reflex activity. It can also directly invade into the spinal cord and involve the cortical spinal tracts, which can explain increased motor tone. Oh man, this is the most I've discussed a neurology case since like ever. I feel like my intracranial pressure is elevated. So to summarize, I would want to get further imaging of the brain and obtain a lumbar puncture. But before doing any of that, I'm concerned for an infectious process within the central nervous system, and I would want to start empiric antimicrobials to cover for possible meningitis. It is too early to further accurately predict, but given her 4 days worth of symptoms and her being relatively stable, I would prioritize a viral or atypical organisms as the likely etiology. Back to you, Bale.
That was fire, Jazz. I just have to say, like, I'm such a fan. I'm like, you know, of the, especially the last comment you made about meningitis implicating the pathways in the spinal cord and also the inhibitory effect it has in the CNS. That was brilliant. So going a little further with the initial labs, her hemoglobin was 11.5. WBC was 1500. Platelets were 345,000, sodium was 143, potassium 3.8, chloride 99, and a random blood glucose was drawn and was 88. She had an elevated C-reactive protein of 25. Serologies for HIV, HBV, and syphilis were negative. And an MRI, magnetic resonance angiography, and venography of the brain were performed and were negative for subarachnoid hemorrhage and thrombosis. No mass lesions were found on the brain MRI. A lumbar puncture was performed and showed an opening pressure of 18, 300 cells, 80% were lymphocytes, glucose was 60, and protein was 120. And I have to say that on the brain MRI, there was no signs of bleeding or brain edema.
So Jazz has set me up for the alley-oop, and all we need is some CSF for the slam dunk. But I'll start with the other labs. CRP is up. She's clearly inflamed, which we know from her low-grade temperature and overall presentation. And Jazz has really zoomed in on the meninges here. I totally agree. But just to close the loop and going back to our schema for secondary headache all the way from aliquot 1, our head and neck bucket with ear, nose, and throat pathology has really totally left the chat. But the MRA, MRV brain has really helped us rule out some morbid causes of secondary headache from the intracranial bucket that, of course, now we're much less concerned about, but it's nice to have some closure. Much less concerned now about thrombosis of the vasculature, including the venous sinuses, and subarachnoid hemorrhage was not seen on imaging. The other thing we ruled out are space-occupying lesions and other causes of hydrocephalus. I would be curious what the read said about the meninges themselves, but that's okay. You know, we have everything that we need. The CBC with a white cell count of 15,000, you know, all that tells me is that we're strengthening our suspicion for an infection, but it's otherwise nonspecific. The slight anemia to 11.5 is likely dilutional in the setting of pregnancy. The real info is in the CSF, where we're seeing a lymphocytosis to 300 with a normal of less than 5 cells. To analyze this a little further, let's go through our schema, which is on the CP Solver's website, for lymphocytosis in the CSF, layering in the other data, an elevated protein where normal would be 15 to 60, and here it was 120, and a normal glucose, where normal is usually around 2/3 of the serum glucose. Serum was measured at 88, and the CSF glucose was 60, which is about 2/3. The first bucket in this schema is infection, most commonly viral, less likely atypical bacteria, fungi, and even parasites. Though, you know, I know this is CP Solvers, but I'm not saying I suspect neurocysticercosis. Autoimmune etiologies, such as CNS vasculitis, CNS manifestations of systemic autoimmune disease, and antibody-mediated encephalitis are also part of the schema in this bucket, as are malignancies, both liquid and solid. I wanted to mention these other entities, but of course, at this stage in the case, I think it's pretty safe to say we're dealing with an infection, and like Jas mentioned, most likely a meningitis. With a normal glucose and a high protein, it's most likely we're dealing with a viral meningitis, as opposed to a bacterial or a fungal one, in which the glucose would be low, and the clinical presentation would probably be more aggressive to boot. The top of my list for causes of viral, or sometimes known as aseptic meningitis, are picornaviruses, which are single-stranded RNA viruses, like the enteroviruses, Coxsackie A, B, and echovirus, and herpes viruses, which are DNA viruses, classically HSV2 and VZV, which are known to cause meningitis. We've already ruled out HIV, and there are a host of other viruses, including West Nile, other arboviruses, that seem pretty unlikely just based on the base rate. As far as next steps, at this point, I would send a CSF gram stain, a culture, and a series of viral PCRs and see what comes back. Jas and Vali, I'd be curious to hear your take on preemptively starting IV acyclovir. Aside from the Bell's palsy history, I'm kind of shaky on whether or not to suspect HSV or VZV over the other much more common enteroviruses that don't require treatment. But that's where I stand right now.
First of all, Mukund, that was phenomenal. I honestly am very impressed with your discussion. And to answer your question directly, if I were taking care of this patient, I would definitely have started her on IV antibiotics, ceftriaxone and vancomycin, and given her duration of 4 days, I would have added IV acyclovir. And then once I saw the CSF results, I would probably felt reassured to continue antiviral therapy until we get further results. Vali, anything to add to that?
I totally agree with what you're saying, Jas. I for sure will start an empiric antibiotic therapy, including antiviral therapy as well. I feel like a great pearl in this because on the ED especially, I find that people are hesitant to start antimicrobial therapy early just because it takes a little bit of time to do the LP. But we can wait, or the LP is going to change for most microorganisms later than 4 hours. So we have that time to kind of, okay, we're going to start this early just so that we can decrease the risk of mortality and whatnot on this patient and, you know, then do the LP. We have that luxury. Another question we had as a team with this patient was if she needed, at this point, esteroids or corticosteroids. What do you think about that? Because on one hand, she doesn't seem on the brain imaging quite inflamed. We're not seeing a lot of cerebral edema, but this patient could potentially have, you know, because of what you mentioned of pregnancy and other factors, like a huge inflammation. So I don't know, would you start her on corticosteroids?
So that's a really great question. I think, and I would have to look up this on up to date, but I believe the evidence on steroids with meningitis is controversial. I personally would have to consult an ID doctor to see if they would, what they would think. But typically, if we're leaning towards aseptic meningitis, vast majority of them, you know, even the IV acyclovir, I believe it helps with reducing the duration of symptoms. It's mostly supportive care. So I would probably say lean towards no. Like you mentioned, there was no MRI evidence of leptomeningeal or any other type of meningeal enhancement. So it seems like the inflammation was there, but minimal, not to the point where it's leading to some type of effects. But Mukund, do you, have you seen something where in cases where they do start steroids?
Yeah, I've seen steroids used in the treatment of bacterial meningitis to address neurological complications such as hearing loss, and specifically in strep pneumomeningitis, where steroids have been shown to reduce mortality.
Awesome. So I feel like before we get the last aliquot, you know, I would like to summarize the case one more time for the audience so we can just refresh ourselves with the important information. So this is a young pregnant woman with history of prior migraine who presents with a acute subacute headaches that worsen with Valsalva maneuvers. On exam, she had low-grade fever and a neurological exam consistent with non-focal upper motor neuron lesion. The CSF was consistent with elevated opening pressure and a lymphocytic pleocytosis. Valet, we're so excited to see what the final diagnosis was.
Okay, so for the last aliquot, a gram of the CSF was negative. Cultures came back negative or didn't grow anything. And a CSF PCR came back positive for varicella zoster virus. And yay, you nailed it.
Wow. You know, when I had shared my little tidbit about my fish at the very beginning, and then I said I was going fishing with that thing about Bell's palsy, and then it turns out actually to be VZV. So I feel really redeemed in like a not clinically authentic way, but that's hilarious. It was a great case, Valet. It was my privilege to be part of this discussion.
I agree. I did not have any go fish comments, but this was such a fantastic case, Valet. And before you go into your teaching points, you know, I was initially worried about discussing a neuro case, but it yielded so much amazing learning for me and I'm sure for our audience as well. So thank you very much. And you all know what time it is, right? It's time for another jazz joke. How come varicella was so easy? How come varicella was so easy to diagnose on the CSF studies?
Why?
Because it wanted to make a viral statement. Please don't fire me.
Yes, it was amazing. Honestly, when I'm struggling through my marathon this Sunday, I'm just going to remember the amazing plethora of jokes that you've given us. So just to finish the case, to wrap up, I have some teaching points that I found this case very interesting on the diagnostic and management standpoint. So just to summarize, VSV encephalitis is usually manifested by headache, vomiting, altered consciousness, or convulsions. Herpes viruses can also manifest with focal neurological alterations as well, just because of the vasculitic component that they can cause, such as hemiparesis, cranial nerve paralysis are also common. And this patient had, you know, a history of what seemed like peripheral palsy. So that's that. You catch it, Mukund. And it's usually preceded by a vesicular rash. However, in patients that are immunocompromised, the vesicular rash may not be part of the presentation. And imaging, it's not categorical, you know, CT can is usually normal, but MRI is the best method for evaluating the brainstem, deep brain structures, and the cerebellum, and identifying any signs of vasculitis. Most common findings are edematous changes with hyperintense areas on the T2 sequence, mainly in the temporal and inferior frontal lobes, with central vasculitis being a frequent complication of VCV encephalitis and also a stenosis of the cerebellar arteries that are often associated with ischemic lesions of the great white matter interface. And this can, you know, lead to sequelae. I have also seen a patient before that had hemiparesis, and she was also pregnant, I must say, secondary to VCV vasculitis. So, yeah. But ultimately, the diagnosis is through studying the CSF. And, you know, we have this amazing diagnostic tool, the PCR on the CSF, that is very good for diagnosing most things, but it doesn't have the best sensitivity for VCV. So that's something that to keep in mind, you know, that in some patients, we may need to send antibodies as well on the CSF to rule out VCV encephalitis. And the sensitivity being not perfect for this virus, that's why the guides, the ITSA guides, also suggest that even if you have a patient that has a negative CSF PCR for VCV or HSV or herpes viruses in general, but a moderate suspicion or a clinical suspicion that they have this encephalitis, you should continue acyclovir because, you know, it can be very deadly. And to that, the treatment of VCV encephalitis involves the intravenous administration of acyclovir at a dose of 10 to 15 milligrams per kilo every 8 hours for 7 to 14 days, but this can also be extended to 21 days in immunocompromised patients. And for the role of steroids, I feel like it's something I also learned on this case because I thought before that it was only considered in bacterial meningitis, but I've learned that a lot of physicians use them also in herpes, meningitis, and encephalitis when there's inflammation. And as you brilliantly pointed out, this patient didn't have a lot of signs on MRI. I know that studies are not categorical on this topic, but just to keep in mind that you may see them in your practice, you know, the use of steroids in these cases as well. Thank you so much. This was brilliant, and I'm really happy that you enjoy your case, and hopefully it helped to hashtag end neurophobia.
It definitely did. Thank you again, Valet.
That's a wrap.
That's a wrap, folks. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
If you like this episode and want more from the Clinical Problem Solvers, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter that includes episode recaps, teaching points, and educational graphics.
And if you'd like to join us live, check out our daily virtual morning reports, where we come together as a global community to discuss cases and learn together. For more information and instructions for signing up, check out the link in the episode description.
See you next time.